sofa. Can you describe your work both in a literal sense and an emotional sense?
Well, literally, we're providing very practical services to people, but there's a whole lot more to it than that. There's all sorts of ethical and moral judgments that we have to make every day, and we have to also make judgments about people's capacity and, you know, whether we need to intervene through a duty of care. So it's a combination of practical things. I mean, my delivery of the practical things is through my management of care workers. I don't actually do that, but that's what my job is, to enable people to do things and do things well.
How is your work important to you?
Well, it's not a work, it's a vocation. It's my whole life has been around having an instinct to care for people, to look after them. Even as a child, I was involved in working with the St John's Ambulance Brigade when I was about 7 or 8, and technically you had to be 11 to join up, and I wasn't allowed to take any exams, but I could practice all the bandaging and all the stuff. So it's not a work, it's a way of life, really. You know, you can call that a vocation if you want, and I do think it's an instinctive thing. Like, you know, an engineer has a gift to be an engineer, or, you know, you have a gift to be a dancer.
But how is it important to you?
It fulfills me. It makes me feel good when I help people and we do a good job.
And kind of linked to that, how is it connected to your identity?
Very much so, because I've been doing it for so long, and as I've already said, it seems to be a part of me rather than something that's separate from me. You know, I don't think of it as going to work, although obviously I do go to a workplace, but prior to me running my own business, you know, I mean, for example, when I worked in a residential care home for older people, when my dad retired from work, he used to come every week and sit and talk to the old gentleman. And, you know, if there was an event, the Strawberry Fair we used to have every year, your gran used to come, and my mum and dad and Auntie Beattie, and, you know, so it's encompassed my whole family, really. So, again, it's more of a lifestyle and a line of work.
Are there any grandmothers or grandfathers or people who have influenced your work? So it doesn't have to be maternal or paternal, I mean anybody, but that you might consider influential or a role model or having an impact on you, so someone that was probably older than you, could have been younger, but is there anyone?
Well, if you're thinking of grandfather figures, as you know, I never had any living grandparents in my lifetime, so I can't say that they influenced me, but
I think particularly, I'm talking specifically in this instance relating to work, yeah, things, so it doesn't have to be, yes, maybe people in your work practice or people you've admired that you've met in a work context that have influenced how you shape your practice as a carer.
Well, I suppose our longest surviving client has been an inspiration, because he is older than me. He's not a grandfather figure, but he has had a lifelong disability, and, you know, he's a wheelchair user, and he does take that into account. He has to, but he does all sorts of community based things like school governorship, stewardship at his church, and, you know, I think he's quite inspiring. And I think, you know, there's been people that I've met who with either terminal illness, MS, multiple sclerosis, when you see how that incapacitates people. And, you know, we had a lady just recently who had motor neurone disease, and her whole being inspired us, and we were encompassed with great love by her family. And, you know, that is very humbling, and so I feel that's a great, great privilege to be part of that person's end of life, really. And, you know, she had the most wicked sense of humour and, you know, was just brilliant, but ever so realistic and accepting of her, what was going to happen to her.
But I think also anyone who's particularly influenced maybe how you care for people.
I'm not sure. I think everybody that I've met, perhaps not everybody, but I think probably some of my lecturers when I was at college in Stockport influenced me and inspired me to see people as individuals and not as labels. I remember one particular lecturer, Don Ayres, who was creative arts. And, you know, we did this Tuesday night class for people with learning disabilities. And, you know, we took a group to London. And I remember going into a restaurant and this service user or client, whatever you want to say, who had a learning disability, took great delight in ordering what he wanted from the waiter and kept calling him my good man. And that was lovely because, you know, for him to have that life experience was just amazing. You know, I don't think he ever envisaged that he'd ever go outside Stockport, but to be in a restaurant as well. It's quite a long time ago now, but...
What course was that?
Well, it was called the Learning for Living course, and it was the first ever course at Stockport College for people with learning disabilities. And it was around trying to skill them up to live independently. Which was quite difficult for some people because they lived with the parents who were very anxious and wanting to. I think parents inspire me as well because, you know, although this can be quite overprotective sometimes, you know, to have a child with a disability is a massively challenging thing, very difficult.
Do you see any connections between what I do and what you do?
Yes, I think I do. I never used to think, I think, you know, you're trying to provoke people into thinking about some abstract concepts sometimes, or make them think about normal, inverted commas, things. And re-look at them, and I think I'm always trying to get people to think about how they approach things and think. I'm trying to get people in authority to think about the domiciliary sector and the realities that we've got to deal with. So we both tend to be a bit campaigning about things, and when we get a bee in our bonnet, we don't kind of let go of it.
Yeah, I guess I think the question of authority is probably similar.
I think it's sheep-like adherence to bad practices and things that are unjust that we both share in common. You know, that we see the inequity in something and it really riles us. And so we can't keep our mouth shut about it and we have to say something about it.
Mm.
I think it's injustice and unfairness that really rattles my cage.
Yeah, but I think I feel like you always taught me to see the complexity of things, and that's where the connection is of like nothing's really ever as straightforward as people make out. Normally because it involves human beings. So there's something, so I guess that's in a way for me the like similarities of you like trying people to bring people's awareness to the complexities of the people that you're dealing with. Which is kind of what I do, but about the complexity of an idea or the, or like not something not being straightforward.
Yeah. Well, I think it's easy to judge people, isn't it? And I think your dad always said I was very judgmental and very moralistic about things. But, and I think that's true to some extent, but it's more about the understanding people's pain, I think. Understanding people's life journey and, you know, appreciating that, you know, we've been quite privileged in many ways, but we worked hard for that privilege of being in a comfortable place. Not just comfortable, but, you know, we're fairly sound as a family, I think. You know, sometimes I think we're not, and sometimes I think we're doing all right. We're a bit weird at times, but, except me, of course, you know, but only that's a joke. But I think, I think it's understanding that, you know, people's behaviour sometimes is challenging, but there's usually a fear or a bad experience or a something behind it. And I hope that I've shown you that love can be a very strong influence in situations, and that, you know, anybody who has had displays their distress through behavioural or language discordant actions, there's usually a reason for that.
Mm. Yeah, I think you have taught us that.
Pardon?
I think you have taught us that.
Yeah.
What work ethic did you want to instil in Amy and I?
I don't ever think I thought of a work ethic. Obviously, you know, the basics of turning up. I wanted to inspire you to fit in amongst people, because, you know, life is about getting along with people and, you know, understanding them, because that way comes your happiness, I think. If you can, you know, rub along and you know, and I think I wanted you to understand your privilege, and I don't mean just in terms of having a stable background, but having a physical health is a massive thing, you know, because when you see people who can't move a muscle, and I remember you failing your driving tests for about the second time and you coming in wailing about it, and I think I said, oh, shut up, you can still sing and dance and move around freely. Something like that. And I really believe that, you know, that until you're struck down by something and you've got something to complain about, then shut up and get on with it, kind of thing. You've taken the influence from me and Dad, because we you know, we are a hard working family, and that's historical. So, you know, you've grown up with the idea that nobody owes you a living. You've got to be committed, you've got to turn up, be reliable. All those things are just taken as read, really, in our family, aren't they?
Yeah.
So, I think, and, you know, there are other people who've influenced that, you know, your aunts and your cousins and, you know, non-family members as well, I think.
What do you find a challenge in relation to your work?
I think still managing people, you know, after all these years, I still find that quite difficult, because I can always see their point of view, and I'm a bit of a wimp, really, when it comes to confrontation. Or, you know, I mean, I will tell people, but I'm not good at the formal processes of disciplining people and, you know, doing formal processes. But I can tell people exactly what I think and why I think what they've done is wrong. But I'm not good at following procedures and stuff like that. So I think that's the bit I find really difficult.
you kind of already answered this, but how do your work and your life intermingle?
Well, although I've said that, you know, my work is part of my life, I also am very conscious that I need to have a separate, private part of my life. And when I was 21, 22, I was promoted to be a senior residential social worker with people recovering from mental illnesses, and a lot of them had had a very long-term mental illness. And to be honest, I wasn't ready for that job. I wasn't experienced, I wasn't supported, I wasn't trained. And I ended up, I couldn't think about anything else. I couldn't sleep, I couldn't think about anything. And I realised that I was heading for oblivion or a breakdown or something if I didn't stop that. So at that point, when I was 22, I decided that I had to keep it out of my personal emotions, really. And emotion's not the right word, but I knew I had to have a separateness from my work, otherwise I wouldn't be able to continue to do it. So I do separate it out to a large extent, because you have to have some separateness to maintain your own mental and physical well-being, really, so that you can continue to do a good job. And I try to put that into practice with all the people who work for us and my managers, because I know that if you have a bit of separate away time, it can make you better at doing the job. And, you know, you do need to have some private life and some fun. I realised also all my youth was spent in working and doing shift work and all that sort of thing. And probably, you know, your dad wasn't a great socialiser and didn't want to go nightclubbing. But I feel in some ways that I didn't have that sort of carefree period of my life where I just did what I wanted to do and, you know, even went clubbing or something, because I was working shifts and I was with, you know, I was already in a relationship with your dad. So I think my work has, in a way, enabled me to stay separate from mainstream life. Which I'm not, it's good in one sense, because I can't really stand some of the things about mainstream life, you know, where everybody does the same thing every week and goes to the pub on a Friday night. I think that would just be mind-bogglingly boring, really. But I do think, you know, it's kind of kept me away from real life, if you know what I mean, or what most people consider real life.
Can you talk about your experience of intergenerational exchange?
Well, I think, you know, again, you know, I grew up in a family, although I didn't have grandparents, there were older people in our family, and they were always treated with great respect and great consideration, you know, because my dad had an auntie and an uncle, so they were my great auntie and uncle. And, you know, we visited them on a very regular basis. And my mum had an auntie called Nellie, who was like a grandparent to us, so we stayed with her when her daughter and son-in-law went away on holiday. So I've grown up in an intergenerational setting, really. You know, my mother would look after old neighbours. There was a lady called Mrs. Dauber when we lived on Station Road, and we would be often sent with a plate of food, you know, a dinner on a plate. We would take that up to Mrs. Dauber up the back entry. So for me, it's a natural, normal thing. I mean, when we go to Saul and Mandy's, and there's like four generations of people there, and everybody interacts. I mean, the children come and talk to Nana, and, you know, for me, it's great, you know, when we have a big extended family, don't we? So I think it's very important for that to happen. It's a natural, for me, it's a sort of natural thing. It's almost like a Mediterranean family, our family. You know, that there's the great grandparents, and then there's all the
well, happens in English families as well.
Well, yeah, but you tend not to think it does, but it does more so than you ever realise. You know, there's an amazing set of, you know, children and grandchildren who care for the older people. We see it a lot in our work, you know, where daughters will do amazing things for the mothers, fathers. And it's mainly
daughters.
It is, I'm afraid, yeah. You know, the brothers go off and don't get involved. Because I don't think men can cope emotionally with it the same. And they've not got the same attachment and psyche to deal with it. And sometimes they're plain lazy. But they don't tend to become engaged. And, you know, very often they can't cope with it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure if that's innate. I think that's probably been taught on some level.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, some males are fantastic, you know, and really, really caring. But I think also, you know, the expectations of older people and society precludes men from taking on a caring role towards an older parent. You know, we've come a long way in terms of men being involved in childcare. And maybe, you know, I mean, we've got older men who don't want male care workers because I think they probably feel threatened, embarrassed. There's a sort of, men tend to have this kind of one-upmanship on each other. And that, again, is to do with the psyches. But, you know, I think that's also to say about how we view caring. And, you know, a lot of what we do, and I've said this to you so many times, what we do in our work is what women do day in, day out, without any recognition whatsoever. You know, they're keeping the house going, they're cooking, they're shopping, and it's invisible. And that's why, you know, our work is undervalued, because it's what women do day in, day out, without any pay, without any recognition. And you know, we have very few male carers in the care industry, really, compared to women. But that's partly because the pay is so poor,
and it's seen as a feminine
task. Yeah,
yeah. What are your concerns for older people?
That they have no voice, really, and, you know, all the rules that apply to... I mean, Anna was telling me about her mum is in a care home, which she's quite relieved about, because when she goes home, she starts to self-neglect and all that sort of thing. So she's been in a hospital, in a care home, home to her own home, back into hospital, and she's done that about 3 or 4 times, and Anna was desperate for her to go into care. But she's paying something like £700 a week, and the staff are saying, you know, your mum's wanting to go to bed after 8 o'clock, or your mum doesn't want to do this and doesn't want to do that, and, you know, almost as if they're complaining about her. And Anna went to see her, and the bathroom was dirty, you know, the toilet and the sink and everything were dirty, and Anna was really cross that her mum is paying all that money to be told that she's being difficult, to not be able to do whatever she wants. So I find that really, I think the way we care for our older people is appalling, because they are so disempowered, I think, a lot of the time, and they have no voice. And, you know, even if you were being treated like that in a hotel, then, you know, you'd complain to the management. But, you know, because she's in a residential care home, it's all right to put everybody to bed at 8 o'clock at night or whatever before the night staff come on. So I think we need to finance the care industry and make it feasible for people to not have to put up with institutionalised behaviours, really. That's my biggest thing, that I think, you know, in my industry, in the domiciliary care side of things, you know, the companies will cram as many calls as they can into the shortest period of time possible. Now, we have people who are working very long days, but we never, ever cut the amount of time that they've got to spend with service users. It might be very tightly packed, but they've still got the amount of time that is contracted to work with that person. So I think the way that older people are diminished by our society, and I mean, one of the sociological theories is that that's because they have no economic power. But whether that will be true when the next cohort of older people come through, because they will be the baby boomers who were born just after the war, and they've, quite a lot of them have had good work histories, so they've got good pensions, they've got better health and stuff because of the health service. Because if you think about the people who are in the 80s and 90s now, they were brought up before the existence of the NHS and, you know, community healthcare and things.
Well, I was just going to say, in a way, if you're paying £700 a week for a care home, you do have economic power because you're paying them.
You do, but the...
You should do.
Yeah, yeah. But the problem is that there aren't enough residential care homes, so it's like supply and demand, isn't it? You're paying £700, but this... 10 people waiting for your bed, so, you know. And I mean, there's no sort of security of tenure for people in residential care homes. You know, if you were living in a flat, then you would have a security, but you have none of that if you're a resident.
What, you mean they can just kick you out?
Yeah, yeah. So I think that should be addressed, really.
Mm.
I think...
Well, the care homes need to reflect more how people live, don't they, in terms of...
Well, they are. I mean, they're a lot of the care homes, like, you know, they have, like, Anna's mum's got an ensuite room.
I meant more in the social and, like, time thing of kind of... Yeah, it might be more tricky to put people to bed at the bedtime they want to go to bed at rather than do it in...
Well, it all comes down to staffing levels,
yeah,
doesn't it?
Yeah, that's what I was just about to say.
And, you know, the problem is... I mean, for us, we can't recruit into domiciliary care, and it's the same for residential care homes. And it's all about, again, the status of what we do, the rates of pay that can be afforded to be paid, just a whole range of issues that we have no control over. And, you know, I would dearly love to pay our care workers £11, £12 an hour. But it's just not economically viable to do that.
What has your work taught you about older people?
That they are people and all individuals, you know, because we tend... Well, there's an awful lot of stereotyping goes on, and there's an awful lot of ageism within our society. You can see it in adverts, you can see it in everything, really, that, you know, people are... labelled as past it, and you know, everybody who's old has got dementia, everybody's old is incontinent, you know, it's just horrible. And that every older person is a younger person who's journeyed there. You know, you don't just get to be old. I mean, on that, you must make also the connection between the way we promote this image that human beings have got flawless skin and shiny hair and perfect figures. That's bad enough for the younger generation to deal with. But if you're 90 and got thousands of wrinkles and your body's deteriorated, how much more do you feel inferior because you don't match this ideological picture of what human beings look like? So there's also that aspect of it, because, you know, a lot of older people don't look particularly appealing physically, because age is a thing that changes your appearance. And I think that must be very difficult for particularly older women, although we are, you know, because of the economic power of the up and coming cohort of older people, there is a marketing strategy beginning to develop to sell things to older people, and there are some models now who are in the 80s and 90s, but it's purely about selling things to people. You know, it's not about saying, you know, older people are human beings too. It's about what can we sell to these now powerful people with economic power.
Mm. Can you describe an ideal society?
No. Well, an ideal society would be one where people were loving and tolerant and understanding of each other and the weaknesses that we all have as human beings, and forgiving of each other. You know, we all can have a rant and a rave, or I think as well, I mean, my ideal world would be somewhere where people understand mental health issues and mental illness in a much more loving and tolerant way, you know. Because, I mean, younger people with mental health problems have enough problems, but older people with mental health problems probably have. I think dementia is becoming probably more understood and more sympathetically tolerated. But I think, you know, if we could just have a society where everybody was valued and, you know, their financial circumstances weren't taken into account, then, you know, that would be... I mean, I was thinking today, you know, there's this candidate for the Tory leadership. I've forgotten the name now, Christine or somebody. And her family have been sorting the tax affairs out, so they pay the minimum amount of tax. Now, she would be, if she was on benefits and she was defrauding, she would be a scrounger.
Mm.
So what's the one rule for her and the one rule for the person on benefits? That's something that really angers me. So I would have a society where money is not taken into consideration in the value of the person.
Who doesn't exist.
Pardon?
Who doesn't exist.
Money doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Yeah. You see, you've got to be realistic and say that, you know, there's been a way of exchanging things just forever, for centuries, you know. Bartering was one way.
Yeah, but it's not this.
And you always get, all those things kind of get distorted sooner or later.
But if you're exchanging things, you can only exchange for what you need or what.
Well, yeah, but I mean, you know, gold coin. Well, that was money, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But you know, there were certain. I mean, like when the pharaohs were buried, they were often buried with like pets and things that had been meaningful to their lives, wasn't it? They weren't always.
But how does that relate to exchange?
I don't know, actually. I'm just thinking that. What the hell did I say that for? But I think whatever anybody says, there's a massive class divisions in our society. And, you know, people... I love that skit about, you know, when John Cleese is in with the two Ronnies, and I look down on him and he looks up to me, and there's that... That kind of sums up what's wrong about that kind of thing. And, you know, I remember your granddad saying about, you know, he was like a skilled, trained fitter. He was a time-served, qualified fitter on the buses. And he used to have a labourer with him to help him do his job. And one of the things that made him give up work was because he could not stand the way people spoke to their labourer. And they'd F and Jeff at them. And Grandad never used that word anyway, but, you know, he always showed respect to people. And that was the thing that really got to him, because he used to say, you know, this is, okay, so this is a labourer man. But he might have watched somebody else or everybody do this same thing to this bus 1,000 times, and he might know more about this particular thing than I know as a fitter, so he can help me and I can help him, so I've got to listen to him. And, you know, whatever status you have in life, you're essential to the society if you're, you know, like if you're a road sweeper or a dustbin man. If the road sweeper or the dustbin man doesn't turn up, you're in a mess. So everybody in society should be given value, not just because of where they are, but because, you know, they are giving, you know. And I'm talking about workers there, really, aren't I? I'm not talking about people who aren't working, but I think I use the word respect a lot as well, you know. It's about kind of respecting and valuing other human beings, really. And even if, I mean, I was watching something on the TV about benefits people in Wales, and you're like, my God, you know, why are you behaving in that way? But you don't know what's happened to that person to make them behave in that way.
Yeah, or how it's been edited to make them look.
Or how it's been edited, yeah, on the TV especially. Because people look at the television and believe everything on it. And that's one of the problems we've got in our society, that little box in the corner has got far too much influence, really, as well. Although it's a great, you know, your Nana watches television quite a lot, but she's quite selective about what she's watching. But it is a quite a malign influence, I think.